had upon the Fatter Makers League, and you were discussing something about the Merritt and Can decision.
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought it was. Now Jerry says it's possibly something else.
The impact that the industrial unions, the CIO and others, on the Pattern Makers League was this, that they included in their representation elections everybody in the shop, production workers, sweepers, pattern makers, everybody in there. So what we had, the only impact it had on us, we had to be on the ball, and if we had, and this was back at that time, we could separate the pattern makers from the industrial union with a separate representation election. I am sure of that because in 1939, the General Motors Truck and Coach Company, I voted separately as a pattern makers unit.
And we did in 48.
This was after a different era. Now, after that, it became a little different thing because we could petition for the pattern makers and separate them from the industrial unions if you filed a timely petition. And I remember the first petition I filed, for a while they only recognized 1 year, and then I was the first one that I think history will show that I was the first one that got hit with the National Labor Relations Board recognized a 2-year agreement. And then eventually they recognized 5-year agreements. So you had held out for 1 year, then 2 years, and then 5 years. You couldn't petition until 60 days prior to the termination date of these agreements. And then along in the late 50s, there was a ruling made by the National Labor Relations Board, not by any act of Landon Griffin or
uh-huh.
American Can or anything.
Uh-huh.
Of course, American Can was a National Labor Relations Board.
That was a decision.
A decision, yes. But that was earlier than this. And mm-hmm. and this, the National Labor Relations Board ruled by the insistence of, let's say, the UAW,
yeah.
that if we're going to take pattern makers, that we take all in their bargaining unit. It made sense. In other words, if they had pattern makers in Saginaw, in a company in Saginaw, Flint, Pontiac, Buffalo, Lima, Ohio, and all these places that General Motors had pattern makers around the country, I could no longer file and take Grand Rapids as a plant and any other technical center.
Mm-hmm.
I had to file for all of them.
Yeah.
So, as a consequence, we've just never gotten them all together, the remaining bunch together yet, to file for the whole group. And this is one of the impacts of the industrial. Well, while the industrial union, you might call it an impact, the industrial union was a big help to the pattern makers too.
Oh yes, made them union minded.
Well, it made them union minded, but further than that, the pattern makers were too small a group. I say that because I know by what I'm talking, because to gain conditions that we were after, we had to have help. Now, this is so clear to me because in the early days of bargaining with General Motors, and we bargained with General Motors just as earlier as the UAW did.
And before.
And little off-the-cuff bargaining even before that. We made proposals to General Motors a long, long time before we got them, and when we got them, UAW and we both got them together.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure that the UAW copied some of our proposals. It's natural because we proposed them before the UAW became into existence.
Mm-hmm.
But
nevertheless, they set the pattern, more or less.
What I'm saying is that they'd give it to the UAW. We waited till the UAW was through, and then we went in after ours. But I can name a number of things that we got that way that we proposed, even as you say before, even before the UAW came in. And all of a sudden, well, here's the union shop, for example. That was just one little thing. And I remember what Louis Seaton said when he said, "Sure, we're going to give you the union shop." He says, "I never liked hitchhikers either." That was the exact words. He said, "I never liked hitchhikers either."
Yeah.
He's retired now, so that won't hurt.
Right.
That ties us in with the next question. It was thereafter that the CIO and the UAW merged. Well, actually, they were both in support of one another. But the UAW began its power surge with the sit-down strikes at GM and Flint and the Battle of the Overpass at Ford. Violence became a key word. For example, Reuther and Frankenstein were beaten by Bennett and his security squad at gate number 4 at Rouge and Dearborn. Subsequently, the NLRB issued a cease and desist order against Ford. Does the Patternmakers League have a history of similar violence? I think that ties in with what we were discussing before about Wilcox Ridge.
Not too much violence on the Patternmakers League.
This is somewhat before my time of organizing, and the Patternmakers, I only hear it through hearsay, but they experience a lot of the same things in years past.
Mm-hmm.
It was nothing unusual for them to get clubbed over the head, the same as, if you're going to, I used to be opposed to any kind of organizing of that type, but if the employers are going to use that, I can't hardly condemn the pattern makers for using the same tactics that the employers were using on them.
But they didn't have the numbers that the UAW, the mass unions had. The mass unions could throw 3,000 people there. The Battermakers could throw 150 at the most.
When you were organizing the Detroit area at the time, you were probably in Detroit at the time this took place. Did you know Mr. Bennett and his so-called security squad?
I didn't know Mr. Bennett personally at Ford.
Bennett
was the head. Bennett was the head of their security or their plant guards or plant police protection at Ford, and the information I have, he hired ex-convicts and etc. as his personnel in Ford Motor Car Company, and I guess it's true. Now, when Henry Ford took over, He shoved Bennett out real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the safe blown, so he took over completely. He had the safe blown and took over.
Is that right?
Well, that's the thing. They said
I get some of these things right from the head personnel of Ford, too.
You hear that Mrs. Ford blamed him for killing Edsel, you know.
Uh-huh.
And, we never called him... Henry, we always called him Mr. Ford. I think that was written by that Bennett. But he hired, I know in the summertime, he hired the football players from the University of Michigan. He was an ex-fighter himself, one of those small guys fought in the Navy. He won some championship in the Navy. I remember back in the early 30s, maybe 30, 31, his daughter ran away with some guy. And that was when it was going all along. You couldn't stop and talk to anyone at Ford. You know, if you ganged up in that thing, you were out.
They really had
a security force in there where General Motors you could. But nevertheless, you got to give Henry Ford the credit for establishing practically the union shop when he says, okay, everybody belongs.
When they organized at Ford, Ford says, that's one thing you have to give Ford credit for. He said, it's going to be union, it's going to be all union. Off the bat.
We had riders right along in every group, the UAW, the Pattern Makers League, and everything else, other than the closed shops. The closed shops, they even outlawed.
The closed shop was illegal.
What are they doing about that? You know, what is it? Jerry, didn't they clear that up a little bit about that closed shop?
The closed...
On the out-of-work lists and hiring lists?
Well, the closed shop as such...
is still illegal.
Has never been made a legal thing because you understand the closed shop is a provision that the only way you can get a job in the shop is through the union office. That's a closed shop.
Right.
And this was outlawed and it's never been changed.
Never has been changed.
No.
Eh? Yet
as far
we can't
as I know,
go
it hasn't been changed since I retired.
That's true, because that took place under the Taft-Hartley law. Also, the checkoff system that we use at Chevrolet, in essence, is illegal. But nonetheless, they use it. They recognize it. You're not supposed to be able to pay your union dues through your payroll deduction.
You're not, eh?
No, but we do use that anyway.
Mm-hmm. See, it's a good thing.
No, it's not really an illegality. It's a technicality.
Uh-huh.
Such as the same essence that you're talking about, the closed shop versus the open shop.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never had my dues checked off. I never would. Of course, I'm was brought up from the old school of union men, and I says I wouldn't have my dues checked off because I thought pay my own dues at the
yeah,
office.
Yeah, but you're not like the other guys. I mean, you're one guy, Jerry.
Yeah.
There are 10 other guys that you've got to jump every month. Hey, you pay your dues. Well, the shop captain is doing half his work doing dues collecting.
Our first union check off of dues was in 1955 or shortly thereafter when we got the pattern makers at Ford Motor Car Company. That was the first case of check off dues we had.
Uh-huh.
We didn't have it at Chevrolet in Saginaw, did we?
Well, we've got it, Jerry, but I don't know. You mentioned 55. I don't know whether we had it.
But anyway, in the Detroit office, it was the first place they had check-off of dues. And I definitely recall, it wasn't a year after we had check-off of dues at Ford, the girl that had been in the office since 1926. Uh-huh. She said to me one day, she says, "Boy, this check-off of dues at Ford is a godsend. This has really helped this office a lot."
Well, we got strike benefits up there, and some of the guys, Jerry, were ineligible, you know, that had been paying their dues. I'm telling you, everyone on down had their dues checked from then on. They had to pay the money anyway, but if they, 13 weeks behind, they'd have to take them so long to catch up, and they lost their strike benefits.
Well, 13 weeks in arrears, and you're out of benefits.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Then you have to wait in that 13 weeks. It's just
you have to wait another three months to become in good standing.
And some of them lost it that way, so what the hell? If you have to pay it anyway, why not let them get out? So they now, down the shop, I'd say 95% of them are checkoffs.
So in essence, then, Mr. Ford, with his concepts, was a benefit and a detriment to unionism.
Well, at the start, he was a detriment.
He fought
the Battle of the Overpass.
He fought, and when he lost.
All the way.
He lost gracefully.
everybody belongs.
Yep.
That was the best thing he ever did for the pattern makers, for organized labor in Michigan, as far as that goes.
Yes, that was a good move.
Did either of you fellas know Ruth or Frankenstein?
Oh, yeah. I knew them personally.
Both? Uh-huh. What type of people were they?
They were real nice people, I thought. Dick Frankenstein was more or less of an opportunist. He ran for city council.
Yes.
There were a couple of cliques, you know. There was the Ruther clique, a caucus you want to call it, and then they had the Frankenstein Addis caucus, and then that from that resulted they were about just about a standoff. The Ruther caucus and the Frankenstein Addis, and there was just about a standoff. Neither one had the what you would call the overwhelming majority, so they put in a pivot man there, R.J. Thomas, and they kept working on it, and finally Ruther won out. Everything went out, see?
That's
all
powerful.
His men went in. Mazie took Addis's place as secretary-treasurer.
I always had a very, very high respect for Walter Ruther. I've always claimed that he was the backbone of the UAW.
Mm-hmm. Good liver. None drinker, none smoker.
Aside from that, he still was a very intelligent person.
Yes, he was.
I mean, he demanded respect, and he got it.
Oh, he was a very good man. That redhead was all right.
I always had high respect for him. I said at the time he was killed in this airplane crash that the labor movement lost probably the most valuable person that I know of that they've had.
Do you feel Woodcock is almost as efficient an administrator?
He hasn't been in long enough. I mean, he's going through a different era.
I see.
I have nothing. I've met Woodcock personally, and
Smitty gave him his first job in the UAW.
Who did? Oh, Smitty.
Mm-hmm. Over in Grand Rapids.
I met Woodcock in a meeting down in Washington several years ago. And in fact, I had a little chat with him off the side of the meeting, as I recall. As I said before, it's hard to, at this stage, say that he's as valuable a man as Walter Ruther. It'd be an awful hard thing for me to say because of the high respect I had for Walter Ruther.
He wouldn't even compare himself with Walter Ruther. Leonard wouldn't.
I see.
He wouldn't compare himself at all. To him, Walter Ruther, I think, was God. You know, he really worshipped that man.
Ruther was very articulate. He was a very good spokesman, wasn't he?
He was a... have you ever heard him?
I've listened to a few of his tapes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And he was a person who... I remember my wife telling about, my wife was a school teacher, incidentally, and Walter Ruther appeared at one of their Michigan Educational Association meetings. And she was very, very highly impressed with him, too. He made a speech at one of their meetings.
Well, he's good like that, like on Meet the Press or anything, you know what I mean, this repartee they had to going back and forth. He was wonderful. He was sharp.
He's sharp, yes.
No, you give him the answer, and before you had it, or the question rather, before you had it half out, that answer was right back. He could read the rest of your head.
Well, he was ahead.
And you're looking at it with your mouth open. You know, how'd you know I was going to finish that way?
Uh-huh.
Terrific.
Well, this is a sharp way of being.
Mm-hmm. I see. What about Frankenstein?
Frankenstein was more busy. In fact, he went into business after that. He lost out in the UAW, ran for councilman down there in Detroit, a mayor, I think it was, that he ran for in Detroit, wasn't it? Went out on that, and then he became a manufacturer's representative.
I just can't remember much history.
Yeah, Dick Frankenstein.
Now, Reuther replaced Homer Martin, didn't he, as the head of the UAW?
Yes. Well, that's when the... No, Homer Martin stayed. He stayed with the UAW AF of L.
Oh, I see.
And that's when the UAW split, and the other was UAW-CIO.
Mm-hmm.
So Martin was AF of L, and that's how the Bannermakers League got their first vote in 1939. And they lost that vote. But then in 1948, was it, Jerry? They won that one.
I'd forgotten about the one in 1939 was when you had the UAW had
their
election.
That's the split, but see, yeah. Talking about, that's the split, and that's when the Vertical Union came in, which is the Bannermakers League, and the Bannermakers League said, we want, because it was UAW AF of L then, we want those Bannermakers. So they took them right out of the middle and out of the vertical thing, and we had the election
The Bannermakers League intervened in all the General Motors shops, as I recall, for separate representation for the Bannermakers. So the Bannermakers brought it upon themselves that they didn't gain their identity in 1939 because of the places that they voted along with UAW.
Uh-huh.
In 1939, Buick voted for the Bannermakers League, Pontiac Motor voted for the Bannermakers League, General Motors Truck and Coach, Fisher Body 23, and then there was another Fisher Body plant that's going out of existence before Fisher 23.
Isn't that something?
It's out now, yes.
Biggest shop they had.
No, the
Bannermakers, wasn't it?
Biggest shop in pattern makers. Yeah. Of course, the biggest shop they have is out in Technical Center.
And for pattern makers, Jerry?
Yes, model makers and pattern makers.
Uh-huh.
All right, if we could move on. In 1947, the Labor Management Relations Act, or the Taft-Hartley, was in essence an attack on organized labor. Section 14, subparagraph B, or the right to work, enables states to forbid union shop agreements. How did this affect the pattern makers' league's arbitrary power?
It didn't affect the Pattern Makers League too much, and particularly in as much as the Supreme Court very shortly afterwards ruled that I have to think of this ruling for a little bit.
That's all right, go ahead.
It didn't affect them to the extent that they weren't bothered by it anyway, you know what I mean? That they were still that small group. They weren't like this mass group that the right to work meant that even though they were on strike, you could walk through that gate. Well, that guys just didn't do that. If they were out on strike, they stayed on strike.
Well, the ruling was, my first experience after this ruling was in negotiating with General Motors. We had a shop down in a General Motors shop down in Indianapolis, the first one that comes to my mind. The right to work law provided that a person did not have to join the union, but the company went along with us in the fact that if they didn't have to join the union, but the Supreme Court ruled. Now, this is a Supreme Court ruling. They didn't have to join the union, but they would have to contribute the same amount that the union men contribute to bring about their conditions. So it was a very short-lived ruling of the union shop, or the right to work law didn't amount to anything.
It was mere rhetoric then. That's beautiful. In the same
act, on the union, that's on the union shop issue.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's still in effect in Michigan and that MEA.
It's still, as I understand, it's still the same way. But their law still is the same too.
Mm-hmm.
That when a union goes into a shop and creates working conditions,
mm-hmm.
and everyone in that shop benefits by the same conditions that everyone else does, the Supreme Court rules that they must pay they're not entitled to, they must, if asked to, pay the same amount.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any difference whether they pay it in a FAR fund or what they pay it into.
In essence, wouldn't this be prejudicial? Because if they were paying into the union dues, not being a union member, in the event that there was a strike or a layoff of some sort, they wouldn't receive support from that union, would they? Where the other people would?
This became a question. I recall discussing this when it first came about. I had The same thing applies. There are certain religions that, and I've run into a few of them, that their religion prohibits them from joining any secret organization. I believe this is the context of their religion. And I've run into a few of these incidents in my organizing efforts where the person was fully in accord with what we're trying to do. But understand, my religion would not permit me to join the union. But understand me, I want to contribute the same as anybody else does in the conditions that we'll get out of this. And I'm thinking of one person particularly when I'm saying these things.
Okay.
And it's not the only one. But I was talking to our general president afterwards. He brings up to your point, in, or part of your point. They did not take any obligation into the union, understand? They paid their same initiation fee, they paid the same dues, without taking an obligation into the union. And as a former general president said this, we have a number of those over in Pennsylvania, you know, the Pennsylvania Dutch. We have a number of those over there, and he says, you know something? I've never yet had a wife return the $400 death benefit I sent to her when her husband died.
Is that right? Well, they were entitled to those benefits then.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it is interesting. All right, in the same act, that is the Taft-Hartley Act, Section 304 made permanent the Smith-Connolly Act of 1940, which placed specific limitations upon labor union contributions from general funds to campaign coffers. In which way did this affect the Patternmakers League's political contributory support?
They never had that much money.
I recall that when this first came about, that there was a voluntary contribution, I believe, of a dollar was suggested. It wasn't a mandatory thing.
No, they cope with something.
As I recall, that and they could give it to whoever they wanted to.
Right.
But the Pattern Makers League was never any great contributor to any campaign.
So politically, the Pattern Makers League has been somewhat independent as far as support of any kind?
100%.
That's right.
All right, in 1955, then, the AFL and the CIO merged again to achieve unification for political influence. The Pattern Makers League, which is affiliated with this merger, was affected in which way? Now,
no,
you mentioned
no
before
way.
That when they split, when the UAW actually split, there were two factions, one under Homer Barton and the other under Walter Reuben.
They left them alone. If they'd wanted them, the UAW left alone, we went in with complete harmony. On this rating issue, was there a deal on that?
There was no, it made no difference. It made no change.
What happened then when the UAW, the AFL and CIO merged again, the UAW, which had split, and the UAW, which had remained, did they merge as well, too?
No. They didn't merge. They merged as separate unions. And there's no merging. It was really just a political merge.
What you're saying is, what difference does it make? It didn't make a bit of difference because, understand, that I had to carve units from AFL shops. I mean, in AFL industrial shops, I carved, offhand I can think of two. One of them, I believe, was in Saginaw and one over in Muskegon.
Did you get Baker Perkins?
Got Baker Perkins,
okay,
and that was in
AFL.
That's
shop,
right. That was one of them
in
Saginaw.
That was their horizontal union again, and you had that permission. A craft could go in and what they would call raid, but there was no raiding because it was in AFL, and the vertical union went in and picked that plant up.
All right,
Lewis bucked against, you know.
Let me say this, we had to go through the same court procedures we did with the UAW.
Is that right,
sir? Yes, sir.
Uh-huh, be
nice.
All right, Steve, you mentioned that the Saginaw Pattern Makers League negotiated their first contract with GM and Saginaw in 1948.
Uh-huh.
How did this take place?
Well, we had our election, and Jerry was there. You were district secretary then, too, weren't you, Jerry?
And I became district secretary in 1946.
Yeah.
Or January the 1st, 1946, and one of my first directions was to organize Buick Motor Car Company. Well, when I went to work on Buick, I simultaneously worked on Chevrolet and Saginaw.
Uh-huh.
And I might say that this is a little bit interesting because the business manager that had been elected that year handed me a list of names, and whether it was or not, but he handed me a list of names from Chevrolet Foundry with stars after their name. These are the stars indicate the degree of importance of these men in the shop. Incidentally, you like one of having the top star in the shop. Linwood Smith had five stars, I think you four, and then there was several fellows with three and some with two.
Uh-huh. Who handed you this information?
The business.
The Animal Weber.
No, what it was.
Engel? No, Engel was president.
He got me. Can't think of his name. He was only a business manager 1 year. I'll think of his name in a minute.
All right. In the meantime, how did you go about organizing GM? What was the first procedure, the process that you would go through?
My first procedure, of course, people have asked me in the past, and in fact, in the last convention, I had a young fellow, Pastor Nick, at the time, who wanted me to come down to Columbus and explain to them how to organize the city. I said, Brother Street, I could come down and tell you how, but each place has to be approached on the basis of what exists in that place. And my approach in Chevrolet, naturally, when a person gives me a name with the ordinarily, I always go some way and try to find out who the most important person is, most influential, I should say, with the men in the shop. And when I was handed this list of names with Linwood Smith, five stars, Harold Stevens, four stars, and then, as I say, three down, what did I do? I went to Linwood Smith's house, the first person I went to see. And I spent a whole evening with him. When I left that evening, well, he said, Jerry, he said, I'll assure you of one thing. He says, I won't do you any harm. He said, in fact, maybe I can do you some good. I said, well, I kind of expect you would, Linwood. And this was my first approach, and I was over to Harold's house too.
Oh, yeah.
And from there on, I sat on the sidelines and let them organize it.
Yeah, well, we had made up our mind. We had been the balance of power at that foundry, you know, and the pattern shop, because we had that vote solid. And whichever way we went, we let them fight down in the production end of it, and they were just about even. Whichever way we swung our vote, that was the side that won. Then Mal House gets in there, and he goes and he starts playing footsie with the one gang. Mm-hmm. Well, he destroyed our balance of power, which took everything away from us. We became one of the factions in the foundry, so you just happened along at the opportune time. We said, we're flying.
Well, I've always said that's another factor in organizing. You have to take advantage of the opportunity when it's there.
That's right, yeah.
I took the job originally. I said I'd taken it as a challenge to organize Pyle Pattern in Muskegon, which had been unorganized since 1917.
Yeah.
It took me 4 years to get it. But what I was just make one other comment about Chevrolet Foundry. Nobody seemed in the job industry seemed to show any interest. Arnold Weber was again elected. He was a business manager when it was over. And Arnold Weber came down to the office the day of the election. He hadn't appeared there before.
Is that right?
But I didn't know he was that much interested. And he sat there, nervous, you know. And, he said, Jerry, he said, if we were only to win Chevrolet by one or two votes, he says, we might better lose it, hadn't we? Well, no, I said, Arnold, if we were only to win it by two or three votes, I'd take it. But then we'd have to finish organizing it after. But Arnold, we're going to win it around 2-1.
Yeah.
But you don't mean that.
Well, I know poor Arnold was afraid.
And Harold Stevens, the one told me we were going to win it 2-1.
he was my friend for a long time, but I knew, and I had told him before that. I said, what the hell, you take us over, you take that and I take you over. But I also promised him that we wouldn't take any offices for a year. Oh, then he started buttering around, and I guess he finally quit, didn't he, and get out.
Where Arnold Weber made a mistake, was a mistake he made probably a lot of other times. Always at election time, he would be nominated and he'd say, I decline. He wanted to be coached to be business manager.
Yeah.
This was the whole thing.
Yeah.
Linwood Smith told me, he says, I won't run against him. I won't.
Yeah. That was the agreement. We wouldn't go for a year.
I didn't remember that. Yeah. But anyway, Arnold Weber was nominated and he declined. Somebody nominated Linwood Smith. Well, I'll accept.
Sure.
Later on, Arnold Weber was nominated again. And he accepted too. So Linwood Smith says, I'm not going back out now.
Yeah, we had the vote. We had twice.